Hey, it's Cole Swindell, and when I spend 200 days a year rolling down the highway, the bus can start to feel smaller than a guitar case. Everyone wonders how I stay chill while the hours crawl by. Truth is, one good luck spent on Chumba, and suddenly the trip feels a whole lot shorter. Finding your space, even when there isn't much to spare. Need some chill? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNCs apply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
Hey, this is Warren Haynes, and you're listening to my weekly mixtape with Brian Colburn, and it's different all the time.
What is going on, friends? Welcome to My Weekly Mixtape, the show that takes the classic mixtape approach to building a modern playlist. I'm your host, Brian Colburn, and joining me tonight is a songwriter and musician who truly needs no introduction, and honestly, anything I say wouldn't do him justice anyway. From the Allman Brothers Band to Government Mule to his incredible body of solo records, it's an absolute honor to welcome the one and only Warren Haynes to the show. Warren, great to have you here, my friend.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Since this is your first time on My Weekly Mixtape, let's start with the basics. What does the word mixtape mean to you?
Interjecting your own personality into music that you would like others to experience.
Great way of putting it. Now, today we're here to talk about the 2026 remix and reissue of Tales of Ordinary Madness, your debut solo album from 1993.
Fire in the kitchen, fire in the kitchen, burn it down. Fire in the kitchen.
What a kickoff Fire in the Kitchen is, man. So what does more than three decades of hindsight tell you about this album's longevity?
You know, I haven't thought of it that way. You know, it was my first solo record, and they say you only make your first record once. So yeah. A lot of thought went into which songs we're going to be on the record. Chuck Lavelle produced it, and he and I went through about, I think, around 30 songs that we were choosing from at that time. And we were choosing based on making a record that was cohesive and where all the songs sounded like they belonged on the same record. There were a lot of songs that I had written back then that were among some of my favorites that didn't necessarily make the cut because they sounded too different from the rest of the songs. I think when I hear it now, I see how much I've grown as a songwriter and how many different directions I've pursued through the years. But I'm very proud of that as an opening statement. It's a little intense, you know, from a songwriting standpoint. There's a lot of aggression and getting things off my chest, but, you know, I guess that goes with making your first record.
Well, you mentioned Chuck Lavelle, who obviously has deep Allman Brothers roots as well. What did you take away working with him that stuck with you for your later bodies of work, as well as your stuff with Government Mule?
Well, oddly enough, at that point, Chuck and I had never met. We knew of each other through our situations in the Allman Brothers Band, and I was a big fan of everything I'd ever heard him do. My manager at the time was friends with Chuck, and when we were talking about possible producers, he brought up Chuck, and I said, yeah, that sounds really cool. I'd like to meet with him. And we had a nice meeting and really hit it off. He's a beautiful person and a fantastic musician, and I was honored to work with him. You know, Chuck was, he struck a good balance as a producer. He wasn't heavy-handed and you know, saying things have to be this way or I think this should go that way. He was kind of part of a panel of people making decisions, and he always had suggestions, and they were always good, but he wasn't like trying to force me to change anything. If I felt strongly about something, he was quick to say, hey, man, it's your record, you know, whatever you think. But he always had really good advice based on his experience. And at that point, he had played on a lot of wonderful records and had a lot of studio experience. I had not so much, you know. and with each record you make, you learn more about the studio environment.
Now, you mentioned earlier that it's a heavy record, and that heft more than certainly shines through on tracks like Kiss Tomorrow Goodbye. It originally came out on Megaforce Records, which when I was growing up, I associated with Metallica, Anthrax, SOD, the metal universe, if you will. How did Tales end up landing on Megaforce initially?
I don't remember exactly how they came to the party, but they wound up making us a better offer than a lot of the other major labels were making at the time. And part of that included me being able to make the record that I wanted to make. John and Marcia Zazula that owned Megaforce were both very passionate about music. And even though their roster was pretty heavy, they had stuff, you know, a lot of the stuff on that label would be stuff I wasn't a fan of, but they had cool stuff like King's X, who I really liked. And they were telling me how they were looking to expand their reach and get out of that mold. And they saw signing me as an opportunity to show people that they weren't just a metal label. And they were really great about saying, hey, this is your record. We want you to make it how you want to make it. And that was really important to me. And they were very passionate.
And were they involved with this new version as well?
Missy Colazzo, who now owns Megaforce Records, John and Marcia both passed away.
Yeah.
And Missy was part of the staff way back then. And she and I did a lot of promo. She would drive me to radio stations. She was the head of promotion back then. But she now owns the label, and we ran into each other at a benefit at the Beacon a few years ago, and we're talking about the 30th anniversary. And I said, well, you know, I've always wanted to remix that record. And she smiled and said, yeah, I think that would be great. Why don't we do that? And so we reached out to Jim Scott, who I've worked with in recent years and who Megaforce has worked with as well. So it was the right choice. Jim's fantastic. He did a wonderful job remixing it, and so they were involved. I was involved. We just worked on it together, and I'm happy with the way it turned out.
As a music fan, Jim Scott's resume is something that is just to be lauded. You have Tom Petty's Wildflowers, Santana's Supernatural, Foo Fighters' One by One. Those are all where his Grammys came from, and that's just scratching the surface. So given your working relationship with him, as well as being the album's original co-producer, were you hands-on with Jim during those remix sessions?
Yeah, Jim and I worked together on two or three projects. And each time, well, one of the projects, I was physically in the room with him when we were mixing. And the other couple of times, he would send me mixes throughout the day to check out and get my input. And I would call him back and say, hey, can we change this, change that? Just subtle little things that are, you know, part of the mixing process. But Jim and I worked great together. And yes, it was like that. And Chuck was involved, especially in the beginning as well. He would send mixes to Chuck and I both, and we would give our input. But Chuck was in the middle of something at that point. And after a few tunes, he's like, you guys got this. I'm going to let you have it.
Now, being you were obviously part of the original album sessions as well as these remix sessions, what would you say Jim's contributions were, as well as what did you hear in differences from the mixes?
Well, I wanted it to be more organic and drier, not so much reverb, not so much EQ and processing. And one of the reasons that I wanted to remix it was because even though I was very happy with that record that we made in 92, came out in 93, records at that time were still being made in a way in accordance with what was going on in the 80s, where everything had a little more reverb, everything had a little more EQ, everything had a little more processing. And so a few years after that record came out, people started returning to a little drier, a little more organic way of recording and mixing. And I thought, well, I would love to hear it that way. And so I've had that in the back of my mind for decades. There was nothing wrong with it at the time, but it had a bit of a time stamp on it. When you listen to it, it sounds like it was made in that time period, because mm-hmm. it was. But why not make it sound like there's no time stamp on it and it could have been made in any decade, you know?
I feel like that's an interesting point, because when Pearl Jam's 10 first came out, Brendan O'Brien did the remix. That was kind of the same mindset, because Pearl Jam's 10 had that sound with a little bit more reverb on everything, and it kind of timestamped the album to 1991. And now the remix version tries to make it something that's a little bit more timeless.
Yeah. And coincidentally, that's one of the records that we listened to when we were mixing Tales of Ordinary Madness. We listened to quite a few records from that time period. And I remember listening to the first Pearl Jam record. And at that time, it sounded really, really good. Yeah. That's a great sounding record. But the same issue that when you think now, their later records don't have quite as much gloss on them. And I'm sure the reason they wanted to remix 10 is the same reason I wanted to remix this record. It's just a product of the time changes. You know, you go back and listen to any record made in the 80s and early 90s, they all have that certain sound about them.
And before we move on, Warren, I just want to let the listeners know that if you want to hear all the songs we're talking about tonight, you can hear them obviously on all the streaming services, or if you pick up a physical copy of the album, but you can also hear embeds of all the tracks over on the episode page at myweeklymixtape.com.
Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what it feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boosts and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at chumbacasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Stay in your world. God knows I'll stay in mine. Drink your poison. Wanna drink my wine. Sit a masquerade in. Someone who cares. I'll be there when they push you down the golden stairs. Do your dirty work, but don't
as a fan and listener who's lived with this record for a long time, and I'm using this clip of Sister Justice as an example, the 2026 mix genuinely makes me feel like I'm hearing Tales of Ordinary Madness for the first time. It reminds me in a way of the first time I heard Steven Wilson's remix of Jethro Tull's Aqualung. It's the same songs, it's the same performances, but suddenly there's this space, depth, and detail in the songs that you never realized was missing because you'd never heard it differently. When you sit down and listen to this new mix now, were there any performance moments that jumped out to you that you maybe didn't realize from the original release based on the mix?
No, not really, other than the bonus track, Tear Me Down. We recorded Tear Me Down, but we weren't able to finish it because we were over budget and out of time. And we had brought in Bernie Worrell to play a bunch of keyboard stuff and Randall Bramlett to play a bunch of saxophone. But we didn't have time to sort through all of it and figure out what we wanted to use. So we just made the decision, mostly a financial decision, to not include it on the record. So I hadn't heard what was on the original tapes until 30 years later. And so I was able to go back into the studio. We didn't re-record anything. We just sorted through all the stuff that had been recorded that we had never really had a chance to listen to and decided, okay, we're going to use this keyboard track. We're going to use this sax track. And Jim Scott mixed it as if it were a brand new tune. And it was always one of my favorites, but now it absolutely is one of my favorite tracks on the record.
And there's something that you did on the re-release that I find absolutely fascinating, because a lot of times it's commonplace when an album is re-released, any bonus material is tacked on at the end of the album.
I knew you were going to say that.
But here, it's Batting Cleanup, or track four, in between Movers and Shakers and I'll Be the One. And this placement feels really calculated. As someone who's probably a fan of the album as an art form, what was your decision in changing the album's original sequence?
Well, I think that's where it would have gone had we finished it. And I think the addition of Tear Me Down makes it a better record, makes it a more diverse record, gives it one more upbeat tune. And so I wanted to put it where I think I would have put it in the sequence back then. I'm very picky about sequencing. And even though I know a lot of people don't care about sequencing, especially these days, so many of our favorite records through the years had an impact on us that was based on the way the records were sequenced. And I made a point of saying, I don't want to put it at the end. I want to put it in the sequence as if it were part of the record. And I think that's was the right decision.
I couldn't agree more. And do you think that streaming comes into play with the fact that maybe people don't think as much about an album listen versus individual tracks anymore?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that changed everything. I encourage young people to listen in sequence, not just to my music, but to music in general. Most artists care enough about the sequence to want to spend time dwelling on it and come up with something that they're proud of. Again, a lot of our favorite records, imagine if the first track wasn't the first track, or the closing track wasn't the closing track. it would have been for a whole different record. So I knew Fire in the Kitchen was going to be the opener, and I knew Broken Promised Land was going to be the closer. The rest of it, I spent a lot of time switching around, and you want the sequence to take you on a journey in the same way that a live show does. And I think all those things are important.
Now I want to touch on a song that I mentioned earlier in passing, that being I'll Be the One. Now, the version we're listening to now is the new remix from Tales. However, on the Mo Voodoo bonus CD, Government Mule did a version on that album as well. As someone who loves pretty much any version of I'll Be the One, I'd love to know how you compare the solo Tales version to the Government Mule rendition from a musical and maybe even emotional perspective.
Well, they're very different. I think. Normally, the Government Mule rendition of something that I've done as a solo artist would probably be heavier, but in this case, it's mellower. I think the original version of I'll Be the One on Tales of Ordinary Madness is pretty loud and pretty aggressive, and I went back and forth when I was writing it and recording it and the way I performed it live. With it not always being that way. I've done it acoustic, which is interesting. But I wanted the version on the Mo Voodoo EP to be a little more R&B and a little less rock. And so that's the way I look at it. I also think the remix that Jim Scott did captures it more than the original mix, even though the original mix was really good. The remix is a little more organic and timeless.
And once again, a reminder to those listening, while I'm playing clips in the episode tonight, you can hear the full versions over on the episode page at myweeklymixtape.com.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Now, Warren, I apologize. I have to sidebar a moment here because during your last answer, you talked about the acoustic version of I'll Be the One. And it brings me to one place. Live at Bonnaroo, 2004. That album to me was such a snapshot and a moment in time, that morning acoustic set. Can you talk about what that performance meant to you? Because there's something about it. There's a magic to it, and it's just a special performance.
I think some of that was that it wasn't intended to be a live album. They had asked me to do a solo set at Bonnaroo, and that was the first time that I had played by myself in front of a big audience. And we recorded it. It's really easy to record a solo set. And after the fact, I thought, you know, it felt pretty good. Maybe we should think about releasing it. But it wasn't until afterward that thought crossed my mind. And maybe part of the reason it felt good was because I was too tired to be nervous. I mean, I don't think I'd ever performed that early ever in my life. And in true Bonnaroo fashion, you know, we were up all night the night before. Got up and drank some coffee and dusted off the cobwebs and went on stage. And I remember being tired, but maybe that worked to my advantage.
I mean, you couldn't tell in the performance.
Well, sometimes that's a good thing. You know, I have this weird kind of rule of thumb, or maybe that's not the right terminology, but this weird philosophy that although you don't want to purposely put yourself in the position of having to perform tired, the times that it happens, in my experience, where you think, oh, I'm fucking exhausted, this is going to be a weird night, somehow they turn out really good.
Well, one thing that I've always admired about you as a musician is how naturally you're able to collaborate with so many artists, including past My Weekly Mixtape guests like Blackberry Smoke and Walter Trout to Kenny Wayne Shepherd and Joe Bonamassa. And that's just scratching the surface. There's also Railroad Earth and Grace Potter on your Ashes and Dust album. In your experience, what makes a musical collaboration feel grounded and natural from the start?
Sometimes it just has to be that unspoken thing that happens that you can't predict or force. But some of that is the right amount of similarity between the two artists and between the influences that make up those artists, and the right amount of contrast. You know, I think for a collaboration to really work, there's got to be a certain degree of contrast, and I think that's a healthy thing. And some of it has to do with mutual respect. You know, if you try to do something and one of the artists doesn't respect the other one, it's probably going to come off insincere. And what I mean by that is you have to accommodate the other person's personality in the way that it's kind of hard to describe, but there's just a vibe that happens when you can feel that mutual respect that elevates the music. You know, I've been in situations where I was very intimidated by the other artist, but they graciously made me feel less intimidated by just showing me a lot of respect and being courteous and compassionate people. Like the first time I worked with Little Milton, the blues artist, who was one of the greats. I worked with him quite a bit and we became really good friends. But the first time we worked together, we had already become pretty good friends, but I was still pretty intimidated by him. And we were in Muscle Shoals making a record. And when it was time for me to do my vocal performance, Milton came and stood in the vocal booth with me.
No pressure.
And then I was like, Milton, get the fuck out of here, man. I'm intimidated enough with you in the building. I don't need you standing right next to me, you know, because he's one of the greatest singers of all times. And he laughed. He's like, okay, I'll get out of here. I was just trying to show you some love, you know. But if that had gone a different direction, the vibe would have been strange. You know, just it worked out because he was a beautiful guy, and we had that mutual respect for each other. And I think that's one of the things that makes it work.
Well, while we're on collaborations, I'd forever kick myself if I don't take this opportunity to at least touch on one solo of yours that truly resonates with me on another level. And that's your stunning slide work on Blues Traveler's The Mountains Win Again. If you'd be so kind, I would love nothing more than to hear a little bit about the backstory behind that incredible solo and how your work with them came together.
Yeah, it's actually an interesting story. Blues Traveler had been doing a lot of stuff with the Allman Brothers. They had opened a lot of shows for us, and we had become friends. And they had asked me to come and play a solo on Mountains Win Again, they didn't specify slide solo. They just said, come play a guitar solo on this track. And coincidentally, Government Mule was kind of looking for a producer at that time because we had not made our first record yet, and we didn't know who we wanted to produce the first record. So Thompson and Barbiero were producing Blues Traveler, and I went in to do that overdub with the two of them in the studio. And I played a couple of solos. One of them might have said, what do you think about slide guitar? And I was like, I felt like at that point, every record that I was playing on, people were asking me to play slide guitar. And I was like, I kind of feel it being non-slide for whatever reason. I don't know why, if I was just being stubborn or that was my first impression. But I played a couple of solos without the slide. And then I think Michael said, you want to try one with the slide? And I was like, sure. Yeah, let's do it. And he says that I brought the slide bottle that was given to me that used to belong to Duane Allman. I don't remember that, but he's probably correct because he usually is. He has a great memory. But he said that I reached in my bag and pulled out that Duane Allman slide and played the slide solo, and that, you know, everybody was like, yeah, that's the one. That's the one we want to use. You know, I love that solo, and I love that song. And I was really honored to be part of that. As I mentioned, Government Mule was thinking about a producer. And so when I went back and was talking to Woody, I was like, you know, I really enjoyed working with Michael. I'd heard that he and Steve Thompson were kind of going separate ways. And I was like, maybe we should try him. I really, really enjoyed working with him. So that experience led to us choosing Michael to produce the first Government Mule record. We actually kind of auditioned him because we were going to record one song for this Hempelation compilation record.
Yeah,
where we did Don't Step on the Grass, Sam. And so I was talking to Woody. I said, why don't we try him for this one track? And if we like him, we'll use him for the album. And so that's the way that whole thing went there.
Unbelievable. Now, you mentioned Government Mule. 2026 is going to be another huge year just for you on the road solo as well as with Government Mule. But beyond all the touring, are there any additional releases or maybe more new music that fans can look forward to this year?
Well, I'm in the midst of trying to figure out what's going to be next from a recording standpoint. But I'm guessing you're referring to the reissue of the first Mule record. We are going to release the first Government Mule record with a bonus disc, an entire CD of unreleased studio outtakes with the original trio with Alan Woody, and it's fantastic. It's really, I went through and hand-selected all this stuff that I didn't know existed or that I didn't realize was as good as it was, a lot of alternate takes, and I'm really happy that we're finally going to put that stuff out because it deserves to be out there.
Now, are these the original mixes or is this like the Tales release, all new mixes from the session?
Most of them are Michael's original rough mixes, which are fantastic. You know, Michael's one of those guys that his live in the studio rough mixes sound like a record. He's just that guy, you know. And we could only choose ones that had an actual vocal performance or something because I didn't want to re-record anything. I wanted it to all be in its original form.
Mm-hmm.
But there was enough stuff to choose from that we're like, wow, we filled up a whole disc of stuff I love.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Well, to close things out and staying with the mixtape mode that this show is all about, what are three songs that you've been listening to lately as Warren Haynes, the fan, not the musician, that you would recommend the listeners check out?
Well, let's see. This one's hard to find. But Ray Charles' version of Oh What a Beautiful Morning is on a record called True to Life, which is out of print. But that version, that vocal performance and that version of that tune is one of the greatest things I've ever heard. What have I been listening to recently? I mean, I'm just being honest with trying to answer the question the best way I can. One of the last records I listened to was Yes, Close to the Edge. I was driving in my car and sat in for the drive and listened to the entire album. I have such diverse taste in music. You know, I mean, I listen to a lot of Miles Davis. I listen to Feliz de Kilimanjaro is a fantastic Miles record. But song-wise, let's see, what else would I put in there? You know, I listened to Little Wing the other day for the first time in a long time, and every time you hear it, you just wish it was longer. You know, it's like such a beautiful piece of music. I would love to hear Jimmy play that for like 8 minutes.
Wouldn't we all? Well, Warren, this has been an absolute honor. Thank you so much for joining me tonight on My Weekly Mixtape.
My pleasure.
And to those listening, you can hear all the songs we've discussed tonight over on the episode page at myweeklymixtape.com, and be sure to pick up a copy of the 2026 remix of Tales of Ordinary Madness, preferably from your favorite indie record store of choice. Now, if you like what you're hearing on the show, I would love to hear from you. myweeklymixtape@gmail.com. Hit me up on social media at myweeklymixtape. You can use the contact page at myweeklymixtape.com, or you can join the Mixtaper community at patreon.com/myweeklymixtape. It's free to join, and there's several tiers there available if you'd like to support the show a little extra, including ad-free early access to episodes, bonus content, and so much more. Once again, that's patreon.com/myweeklymixtape. Now, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, wherever that may be, please leave a 5-star review, a thumbs up, a gold star, drop a comment, you know, do all the things and help spread the word about My Weekly Mixtape to other music fans out there who might be interested in the show. Once again, my name is Brian Colburn. This has been My Weekly Mixtape, and until next time, enjoy the tunes.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode, and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.